why young men and women were rising up in anger, frustration, desperation, saw that action as deeply related to the attention that the country was paying to the devastation it was doing in Vietnam. And so King was actually trying to bring the country together to sense the relationship between its sickness at home to the sickness of its policy overseas.
Vincent Harding, the historian, author, professor, and civil rights activist, died Monday at the age of 82 in Colorado. He was a friend and a speechwriter for Dr. Martin Luther King, and he wrote the draft for Dr. King's famous anti-war address that he gave at Riverside Church April 4th, 1967. Vince Harding was also professor emeritus of religion and social transformation at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver. We will link to all our broadcasts of interviews with Dr. Vince Harding. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nathaniel Sorrent, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman, Van Manta.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:01. Stay tuned for KBOO Evening News.
Thank you, baby. I just want to take a little time out to you. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Summation needs a TTT. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to celebrate International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. We will celebrate children from around the world and honor the diverse cultures that exist and thrive in the Portland area. The International Children's Day festivities will offer a rich intercultural program that will include singing, acting, puppet shows, arts and crafts, and ethnic food. Again, that's International Children's Day with Visegrad Group PDX on Sunday, June 1st from 1:30 p.m. to 5 at the Brentwood Darlington Community Center, 7211 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
Prison guards in Oregon will soon be allowed to carry home their state-issued handguns.
Pennsylvania becomes the 18th state to allow same-sex marriage.
And we'll hear a report from a protest organized by postal workers at a local Staples office store. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 20th, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Emily Young. Today is Election Day in Multnomah County and other counties and cities around the country. On the ballot today are the seats of two of Portland City Commissioners, Nick Fish and Dan Saltzman, as well as county commissioners and judges. Also on the ballot is a measure that would create a public utility district for Portland's Water Bureau. Supporters of the measure say that the city's Water Bureau has been mismanaged and the new district would allow for more accountability and transparency. But opponents claim that big corporate water users are supporting the measure because it will allow them to manipulate water rates. Voters have until 8 p.m. to return their ballots to a county election office or a drop box at your nearest library.
The city of Portland recently decided to partially divest its holdings in Walmart. And a new study of the city's financial documents shows that the divestment has a financial benefit, in addition to its moral commitment to socially responsible investment. Portland's newest city commissioner, Steve Novak, led the push to divest from Walmart due to its poor record of labor practices. The $9 million investment in Walmart that was canceled last week had netted the city just over $33,000 in a year, or one-third of 1%, according to the Office of Management and Finance. The city's $1.26 billion portfolio has done slightly better, returning out about 0.5%. The new social investment policy takes into account a company's track record, such as labor practices.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 13,000 University of California student workers are planning a statewide strike during finals week to protest the university's intimidation of teaching assistant union members. Josh Brahinsky is a student worker activist with UAW Local 2865.
This is a strike, as in all strikes, that we're hoping to avoid. We would like to solve these issues. And we would really like to sit down with the UCs and come to a peaceful resolution.
The statewide strike at the University of California is set to start June 7th. Brahinsky says ever since the Student Worker Union began taking on quality of education social issues like class sizes and equal access to education for undocumented students, the intimidation against union members has increased.
In the last month, it's kind of gone hostile. Leading up to a previous action, there was an administrator at UCSC who told a bunch of our students who were also workers or working for him, he said to them, if you strike, you're never going to work in this department again. Then when we had a strike, which was against intimidation, there were a bunch of workers on the picket line who were arrested. The UCs brought in 30 riot police or police in riot gear from UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco, and they came and arrested a whole bunch of people who were peacefully picketing. And since then, the folks who were arrested have also faced charges, student disciplinary charges.
As many as 700,000 construction jobs could be lost in the coming year if the U.S. Highway Trust Fund is allowed to go bankrupt. Unless Congress acts, the fund could run out of money by August, and that would delay as many as 112,000 roadway projects and 5,600 transit projects. The fund is financed through gas and diesel taxes. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox says the moment is dire. The Congressional Budget Office says to keep the highway fund solvent, the federal gas tax would have to go up by 10 or 15 cents per gallon, or between $13 billion and $18 billion per year from other sources would have to be found just to maintain current highway projects. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says every infrastructure dollar spent generates $1.60 in gross domestic product, and every $1 billion invested in infrastructure creates at least 20,000 jobs. Hundreds of McDonald's workers Thursday will take their campaign for $15 an hour and a union to the McDonald's annual shareholders meeting in Oak Brook, Illinois. More than 2,000 supporters plan to join the McDonald's workers. The McDonald's workers say they're coming to the shareholders. More than 2,000 McDonald's workers say they're coming to the shareholders meeting because the company refuses to listen to them. The fast food worker movement for $15 and a union started in 2012 in New York City when 200 fast food workers walked off their jobs in a strike. Today, there are thousands of workers in the movement.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. The Bank of Labor is the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Another protest over the weekend in Portland challenged a U.S. Postal Service plan to privatize some postal services by opening centers in Staples office stores. 70 protesters chanting, "The U.S. mail is not for sale," picketed the Staples office supply store in Cascade Station Shopping Center before being kicked off the premises by mall security Sunday afternoon. KBOO's Sequoia Wright spoke with Jamie Partridge, who helped organize the protest.
So Jamie, where was this protest against Staples office? Where was this actual protest at?
Well, we had 70 protesters chanting, "The U.S. mail is not for sale," out in front of the Staples office supply store at the Cascade Station Shopping Center.
from what I understand, Staples is going to be used as a way for purchasing stamps and other logistics to get mail out. Is this correct? Or what is the protest about? Why are postal workers protesting Staples?
Staples is setting up knockoff post offices inside their stores that jeopardize our national, our public post offices, our community post offices. They jeopardize the sanctity of the mail and, of course, thousands of good jobs at living wages. Staples has contracted with the U.S. Postal Service to staff post offices installed inside their stores, and they've already set up 82 post offices inside Staples stores. None in Portland yet, but if they're successful in these other areas, using low-paid, non-postal Staples workers to run these stores, they will roll out post offices inside every one of the 1,600 Staples stores across the nation, including the four or five in the Portland area.
How many Staples stores are participating in this so far around the nation?
There are 82, and they're in the San Francisco Bay Area, Atlanta, and Pittsburgh and Western Massachusetts at this point. We're trying to send a message in every city where there are Staples stores to the public and to Staples management that we won't put up with the U.S. mail being privatized and the sanctity of the mail and the protection of the U.S. mail being compromised, and of course the destruction of good living wage jobs. And we're calling on customers to boycott Staples and hold the Staples Corporation accountable for what they're doing.
Is this what it basically comes down to? Is it privatization of mail service and workers?
Yeah, this is a part of a larger scheme by the 1% by Wall Street to take over the Postal Service, which is a $67 billion business, profitable, even despite the headlines that suggest that it's in a financial crisis. It's a phony financial crisis, but the Postmaster General is in league with the profiteers, privatizers, and it's selling off bits and pieces of the Postal Service, starting with the retail, with the community post offices through this Staples scheme.
The 70 protesters that were at the Cascade Staples office, they were escorted off or being kicked off the premises by security. What did they do?
Well, we lined up in front of the store, and we were passing out flyers to folks coming by, and then we cranked up the bullhorn. We were chanting and we were picketing in front of the store and urging people not to shop. And we were on the mall on private property, and so we were kicked off by the security. But we'll be back, and we'll be doing the same thing at other Staples stores in the Portland area. And we want to encourage other folks to join us. They can get involved in this struggle by contacting Communities and Postal Workers United at 503-752-5112.
All right. And any other stores that you know of right now that you can say that protesters will be out for sure?
We'll be out at the store on 122nd and Gleason shortly. Stay tuned.
All right. And anything else you would like to add about the Staples offices becoming post office inside their stores? Is there anything else you'd like to add about this?
Well, it's really unfortunate that people's mail will be compromised by these Staples knockoff post offices, and we encourage individuals and institutions to boycott Staples, particularly those connected with schools, because Staples, a third of their business is school supplies, and we encourage folks to commit to not shopping at Staples until this is turned around, and to let Staples Company and the American Postal Workers Union know if they decide to boycott.
Okay, and one more time, where can people reach you to participate in these protests, upcoming protests going on at Staples?
At 503-752-5112.
All right, I'm Sequoia Wright for KBOO Evening News, speaking with Jamie Partridge, postal workers activist. And thank you, Jamie, for the update.
Thank you, Sequoyna.
KBOO Evening News, I'm Sequoyna Wright.
A new state law will soon allow correctional officers to transport personal firearms in their cars from home to work in Oregon's prisons. House Bill 4035 was born after an officer was killed in 2011 because he stopped to help someone having car trouble. But the new law will come with restrictions. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Senator Jenny Burdick was the only one to vote against the bill that passed 29-1 in the last legislative session. According to Department of Corrections spokesperson Elizabeth Craig, it was sponsored by labor partners of the DOC.
And so we are working to implement the bill as it was written by the time that we have been given, which is we have to implement the bill by June 6th of this year, so we're coming up pretty close. However, we still are going to be putting forward legislation in the 2015 session to address some of the issues that the bill did not take into consideration. So right now there's kind of two phases. Phase one is implementing the bill as it is written by June 6th, and then phase two will be developing a legislative concept to address some of the outstanding issues in the 2015 session.
Some of the concerns we do have about it, I'd be happy to discuss with you.
Ceasefire Oregon and spokesperson Penny Okamoto said the organization did not take an official position on the bill, seeing it instead as a workplace safety issue. But Ms. Okamoto said the organization did have some concerns.
First of all, we're very happy that the state is focusing on safe storage of the weapons once they're at the place of work, because we are very concerned about weapon use at work and you know, basically having guns in the workplace. It's an important issue. Our second concern, though, really has to do with training. We want to make sure that people who are going to be carrying these weapons are very well trained. When someone tries to get a concealed carry weapons permit, that person does not ever even need to shoot a gun. So there's no idea if that person is a good shot, a bad shot. There's no practice in intense situations. So we would really like to see training that is more rigorous, live firearm training, as part of a concealed carry weapons permit.
Ms. Okamoto said the last concern of Ceasefire Oregon is to make sure that corrections officers not only have firearms training, but situational training, so they know how to deal with attackers that may or may not have mental illnesses. Will they be able to enter private establishments that restrict guns like police can now, but they won't be able to arrest?
Our officers don't have arrest authority. So what the bill really does is allows them to carry their personal firearm in their personal vehicle to and from work. And what the department is doing is we're providing lockers for the storage of those personal firearms on our facility property.
Does the correctional system in Oregon issue guards firearms once they get to work?
No, our officers by and large are not armed. We have several posts that are armed posts within our institutions. So, for example, if you think of the state penitentiary or any of our facilities that have the towers, those are posts that are armed. But those officers that are working in housing units, that are working in the visiting room, that are working, you know, inside our facilities, by and large, are not armed. So if you're an officer and you're carrying on your way to work, then when you get to work, you will store your personal firearm in one of these lockers. You will then go into work, do your shift, and when you leave, you will take your firearm from the locker and then put it in your car and go home.
So then the officers know then that they are merely using their vehicle to transport their weapon. They're not supposed to be carrying their weapon.
That's correct. The bill is very clear in that it is only for storing a personal vehicle while the person is at work on official capacity, and only if the person holds a valid concealed handgun license.
Ms. Craig says corrections officers do not have arrest authority and should not carry their weapons into establishments. The law intends to allow them to defend themselves only in the vicinity of their vehicles. So then, do you know of any other state agencies that may allow state workers afraid for their safety to carry guns, like judges or legislators or district attorneys?
You know, that's a good question. We actually did, or are in the process of surveying our partner agencies across the country, the other state departments of corrections, to see what their current practices are. So if they allow this to happen, if so, what kind of rules, policies, plans do they have that govern this issue? So we're asking that same question. We're trying to figure out what our cohorts are doing across the country.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
City of Sacramento is about halfway through installing water meters, but finishing the job is expected to take another decade, putting the state capital well behind other California cities in terms of meters and water conservation. The 20-year installation job is costing the city about $474 million. For more, we go to Joe Rubin with the California Report.
I'm in a Sacramento neighborhood where they're getting water meters installed. The first thing I notice is what a big production it is. There are backhoes, dump trucks, jackhammers, paving equipment. It's all part of why the price to put meters in this city is estimated to be a staggering $474 million. Ratepayers will be shouldering the cost for decades. But does it have to be this involved? A phone call to Fresno is instructive.
This is Robert.
That's Robert Anderson from the Water Department in Fresno. In 2 years, Anderson pulled off the Herculean feat of installing 105,000 meters, about the same number as Sacramento needs. But Fresno's average cost per meter was less than $700. In Sacramento, it's approaching $5,000 and rising. Anderson says the key to getting it done quickly and cheaply is keeping things simple. For example, in Fresno, he put the meters in people's front lawns, while in Sacramento, they're busting up sidewalks.
That would raise the price quite a bit, I would say. If it was in the grass area, all you'd have to do is dig up an area for the box.
Just that difference, installing the meters in sidewalks rather than front yards, is costing Sacramento more than $50 million. But by far the biggest ticket item in Sacramento's installation job is replacing backyard mains, city water pipes that run along the fence line behind homes in older neighborhoods. Sacramento officials made the decision to combine the water meter installation with a much bigger job, digging up every backyard main and relocating them under the streets. Because there are thousands of them, replacing the mains is a big deal. It means street closures and disruptions to neighborhoods for months at a time. Chris Powell is a construction supervisor for the city's Department of Utilities. He justifies all this with the metaphor of replacing an old car.
At 10 years, you start making that decision. Well, do I keep putting money into it and keeping it going, knowing that eventually you're going to have to buy a new car? You're either going to pay now or you're going to pay later.
Okay, check your depth. Before you pop your head.
Just a few miles away, I visit another installation job. There are older homes with big trees offering shade from the midday sun. But this is not Sacramento. It's Elk Grove. The first thing I notice, it's quiet.
Oh, you can actually make the turn.
Mark Madison is general manager of the Elk Grove Water District.
You see, with that drill, they are actually able to steer the drill and make it bend.
This home, like several hundred here, has a backyard water main. But Madison doesn't see any reason to pull it out. He says it's fine for now.
Absolutely. In our opinion, that there are backyard mains that are okay.
As Madison has encountered backyard mains, he's opted to leave them in place 95% of the time.
Typically, you would want to relocate a backyard main because either its condition is poor or the nature of that particular main relative to property represents a liability to the agency.
Instead of digging up yards, Madison's crew uses a machine that snakes plastic water lines underground to the front of homes, where a meter is neatly installed in the grass.
These two lines we shot from the back of the house out to the front are making the connections right now to the water meter.
It surely saves us a lot of money to run the two poly lines and connect and leave the backyard line in place, as opposed to just digging up the entire street, which is very disruptive socially.
Madison's less intrusive approach saves money. It's about a fifth as costly as Sacramento's policy of putting whole new water mains in. He also saves time. Elk Grove expects to finish installing meters this summer, a decade ahead of the state mandate.
Call this.
This summer, a decade ahead of the state mandate.
Call this meeting to order of the City Council Audit
committee. Please call the roll.
In 2011, City Auditor Jorge Oseguera took a close look at the water meter program.
The first finding focused on the replacement of water meters and determined that backyard water mains are being replaced and moved to the street prior to the end of their useful life.
Oseguera's report said the wholesale removal of backyard water mains is misguided. He suggested that many could have decades of useful life remaining.
By keeping the water meters in the backyards instead of moving them to the street, the city could save a significant amount of money.
How much money? According to the city's own estimates, replacing all those backyard water mains will cost $300 million. The Department of Utilities disputes the audit findings and continues replacing backyard mains. At this point, Sacramento is still on track to spend hundreds of millions of dollars and take another 10 years to finish the job. For the California Report, I'm Joe Rubin in Sacramento.
A federal agency ruled today that marijuana growers in the Pacific Northwest are not allowed to use water from the Bureau of Reclamation to irrigate their crops. The water in question is overflow from dams that are run by the federal government. The water is frequently used by farmers to maintain their crops, but since marijuana is illegal under federal law, state laws that allow marijuana do not apply in this case. Washington and Colorado both allow marijuana for recreational use, and over a dozen other states allow medical marijuana. But these states continue to face scrutiny and raids from the federal government, which considers marijuana to be a Class 1 drug. The Reclamation Bureau provides irrigation water in 17 states, mostly in the West. The prohibition against using that water to grow marijuana applies to all 17. It's unknown how many growers had planned to use federal reclaimed water to irrigate their marijuana crops. If the agency discovers anyone using federal water to grow marijuana, it will refer the case to the U.S. Department of Justice.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for The Union Edge, produced by the Working Families Network, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Max Voltage of Home Momentum to talk about upcoming album releases and a party on May 30th. Later in the show, Thomas of Wild Planet Radio and author Tina Gilbertson will discuss her new book, Constructive Wallowing, How to Beat Bad Feelings by Letting Yourself Have Them. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock Radio will focus on the so-called war on drugs and the effects on children of the introduction of crack cocaine. Hard Knock Radio also speaks with former Black Panther member Mama Ayana and Makani Themba of Praxis Institute. Tomorrow's weather is a high of 76 degrees with decreasing clouds and a night low of 51 degrees. Our friends at radcast.org weren't able to provide a radiation count for today due to lack of volunteer support. If you are interested in helping with a citizen-led radiation count, contact the organizers at radcast.org. Today in history, on May 20th, 1961, an angry mob of white men attacked a busload of freedom riders who were testing the United States Supreme Court decision, Boynton v. Virginia, that gave them the legal right to disregard local segregation ordinances regarding interstate transportation facilities. The incident took place in Montgomery, Alabama, prompting the federal government to send in the United States Marshals to restore order. The quote of the day is from author Kurt Vonnegut. A purpose of human life, no matter who is controlling it, is to love whoever is around to be loved.
It's 5:29. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Gosh, you've got to feel sorry for Pfizer. The poor drug giant has to pay taxes in our country, so it's leaving. When I say poor drug giant, I don't mean Pfizer is broke or in the poorhouse. No, no. The pill peddler is incredibly rich, hauling in some $50 billion a year on sales of Viagra, Lipitor, Celebrex, and such. However, the powerhouse drug maker feels put upon by what its CEO calls America's uncompetitive tax rate. So, poor baby, Pfizer says it must renounce its citizenship in our country, flee to the lower tax sanctuary of England, and reincorporate as a British firm. But before you weep for Pfizer and curse America's corporate tax rate, note that corporations use a mess of loopholes to avoid paying anywhere near the official rate. In fact, while Pfizer hauled in more than $17 billion in profits from its U.S. sales from 2010 through 2012, it paid zero income taxes to our nation and actually got a rebate from us taxpayers of $2.2 billion. Special tax breaks are hardly all that this expatriate ingrate gets from us. How about that fat subsidy called Medicare Part D that its lobbyists wrote and got George W. to ram into law? It's a huge chunk of corporate socialism that forces taxpayers to shell out billions a year to cover whatever rip-off prices Pfizer and other big pharma profiteers choose to charge for the medicines that seniors get. Yet, while this corporate greedhead says it no longer wants to be an American, it most certainly does want to keep getting this platinum-covered welfare payment from the American government it supposedly disdains. This is Jim Hightower saying, while Pfizer wants to move its citizenship, it wants to keep its top executives in the good old USA. No, if Pfizer disowns America, America should disown it.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A rally in Dallas, Texas, this past weekend was met by protesters who claimed that the organizers were trying to drum up hatred for Islam and Muslims. The protest was led by faith leaders who had initially asked the rally organizers to drop the anti-Islamic speakers from the agenda. The Council on American-Islamic Relations said that local Muslims sought to join the rally in support of Christian rights, but only if the anti-Muslim speakers were dropped. Rally organizers refused that request. Aliyah Salem with the Council on American-Islamic Relations spoke on KBOO's Air Cascadia this morning.
A little bit less than a month ago, we received word that there was going to be a rally to raise the awareness of the persecution of Christians in Muslim-majority countries. And as a civil rights and advocacy organization, we felt that was a legitimate and worthy human rights issue that we wanted to be a part of and raise awareness. A local church in Dallas were the responsible organizing party for this rally. We noticed that the speakers that they were bringing, however, to participate in this event were individuals whose organizations have been listed as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, a man by the name of Robert Spencer in particular, whose organization, Jihad Watch and Stop the Islamization of America, and others have been listed by the SPLC as a designated hate group. And so that brought us some concern as to what the actual agenda of the rally was, and two other individuals. Robert Spencer, for your listeners, his work and his anti-Islam rhetoric and activism inspired the Norway terrorist Anders Breivik. His manifesto cited Spencer's organization over 196 times and mentioned Spencer himself as an inspiration. So that was really concerning and scary for us. So we tried to encourage the pastor to remove these speakers and allow us to participate and share in this awareness campaign. Our request was declined after a number of attempts, and so what we helped try and do is work with our local peace center and local activists to gather together, inform pastors of what was happening, Christian pastors in the community, and, you know, let them know what was happening and see what they could do about it. So they decided to organize a peace rally in opposition to the hate rally, because we were pretty sure that the mission wasn't what the stated agenda was, but rather it was to spread more anti-Islam hate rhetoric, fear, and propaganda under this guise of a legitimate human rights cause. So several pastors, we had about 15 people show up, and it wasn't we did not publicize it to the community. It was the press release went out, but that was the extent. It was more intended to have faith leaders. The faith leaders themselves decided that they wanted to be the ones to show up and stand up against this, and that's exactly what happened. You know, I think part of it has to do with there are some people who have concerns and fears, and then people who are much more knowledgeable and who do not have good intentions prey on those fears. So if people see things that are being reported in the media, and they see things that scare them in the world, that have people who are Muslim, who are committing crimes that go against Islamic teachings, but the media, you know, portrays that and oftentimes tends to be very one-sided.
That was Aliyah Salem with the Council on American Islamic Relations speaking on a recent hate rally held in Dallas, Texas.
Just one day after Oregon's historic ruling that allows same-sex couples to be married, Pennsylvania today became the 18th state to allow marriage equality. A federal judge struck down Pennsylvania's ban on marriage for same-sex couples on the grounds that it violates the Constitution by discriminating against gay couples. The judge's order, which went into effect immediately, directs the Commonwealth to allow same-sex couples to marry and to recognize valid out-of-state marriages. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of a widow, 11 couples who either wish to marry in Pennsylvania or want the state to recognize their out-of-state marriages, and two teenage children of one of the plaintiff couples. In his opinion, Judge John Jones referred to the ruling that ended segregation in schools, which was made 60 years ago this week. Jones said that in the 60 years since Brown was decided, separate has faded into memory and only equal remains. He said that in future generations, the label same-sex marriage will be abandoned to be replaced simply by marriage. The state of Pennsylvania has 30 days to decide whether to appeal.
After months of political uncertainty, military officials declared martial law in Thailand today. The Thai army, insisting that this is not a coup, has taken the authority to enforce curfews, take up arms against rioters, censor information, prohibit public gatherings, and arrest and detain people for up to 7 days, among other powers. The Royal Thai Army chief, in a televised speech, told the people that the army, quote, intends to bring peace to the beloved country, unquote. So far, things are reported to have remained relatively peaceful. Soldiers are occupying street corners and are taking positions at barricades erected around Bangkok. Critics say that the move is to silence dissent and to censor political opposition. The army has been encircling protesters and evicting groups of anti-government protesters.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, the former U.S. Secretary for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia, David Sedney, has suggested that a neutral figure be appointed as chairman of new peace talks between rival Afghan parties. David Sedney said that the U.S. and NATO should look to the peace process in Northern Ireland as a model for the potential peace process in Afghanistan. Sedney also recommended that a force of 15,000 troops should be left behind to continue efforts to adequately train, mentor, and equip Afghan security forces.
A newly released surveillance video showing the killing of two teenage boys, aged 16 and 17, by Israeli troops during a demonstration last week contradicts Israeli accounts of the incident. While the Israeli government claimed that the boys were throwing stones, the video clearly shows that neither they nor any other youth were throwing stones at the time the shots were fired. They were in the same area where a protest had been taking place outside of Afar prison to mark the occasion of Nakba, or catastrophe, on May 15th. But at the time of the shooting, the two boys but at the time of this shooting of the two boys, the protest was in a lull. The video shows one boy walking slowly by himself with no one around him and no protesters nearby, and then falling to the ground from a fatal gunshot wound. A few minutes later, the second child is walking slowly in nearly the same spot when he too falls to the ground from a gunshot wound. According to the Defense for Children International, the images captured on video show unlawful killings where neither child presented a direct and immediate threat to life at the time of their shooting. The Israeli government said that it would launch a limited investigation into the incident.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, May 20th, 2014. Two Palestinian workers killed in Israel and Israeli troops invade West Bank communities and kidnap 11 civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinian workers have died in a fire in central Israel, while another has been injured after jumping to safety, according to medical sources. Medics said that the two men, both from the northern West Bank city of Nablus, were killed in a fire which started in a banquet hall in Beit Nahamiya. Another worker was injured after he jumped from the second floor of the building, upon which he was taken to Asaf Harfe Medical Center in Beit Ihtikva. Earlier today, a young Palestinian was injured after he was hit by a high-velocity tear gas canister during clashes with Israeli troops in the southern West Bank town of Yatta, according to local officials. Tamer Raed Abu Sabah was taken to a nearby hospital after being hit by the canister. According to local sources, the clashes took place near the offices of Yatta municipality, where Israeli soldiers bombarded the area with tear gas and stun grenades, which caused a state of alarm among the residents. Also on Tuesday, Israeli forces kidnapped four Palestinians, including two minors, from the Hebron area in southern West Bank, in addition to seven others from inside the yards of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, according to reports by security forces and witnesses. A group of settlers under the protection of special Israeli police stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque from the Mughrabi Moroccan gate, provoking Palestinian worshippers who protested their entry to the holy site. Israeli police intervened and abducted seven Palestinian worshippers when they attempted to stop the settlers. All seven men were led to a nearby detention and interrogation center in Jerusalem. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, May 20th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast was Don Merrill and Emily Young. The producer and our engineer is the amazing Sequoia Wright. Special thanks to Chris Andre. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH in Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 90.9 FM. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. His guest is Jacqueline Keeler, Navajo and Yankton Dakota writer, mom, thinker, and idealist. At 9, on Political Perspectives, we speak with Reverend Edward Pinckney, a leader in the fight against the corporations and for a just society. He led an effort to recall Benton Harbor Mayor James Hightower. He now faces up to 25 years for vote fraud charges. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on The Food Show, Margaret Gray, author of the book Labor and the Locavore, talks about labor issues in regional agricultural systems. Michael Weberman, executive director of the Farm Animal Rights Movement, talks about unethical practices perpetuated by the meat industry. And we will visit Heart to Heart Farms from Sherwood, Oregon. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And stay tuned for Union Edge, a report on working people across the country produced by the Working Family Radio Network. Good night, Kristen.
Good night, Emily.
Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate that. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. Also, don't forget, folks, you can join our fan club. Go to theunionedge.com. It's on the right-hand side. Just click the link. It's self-explanatory. We appreciate that very much. Right now on the phone, we have Stuart Acuff, organizer extraordinaire. Stuart, welcome back.
And president of the fan club.
There you go, man. There you go. We appreciate that very much. So, Stuart, number of things going on. Very interesting. We have seen the fast food workers in the fight for minimum wage increase go from one or two locations to national to now international.
Oh, man, it's exciting. It's so great. It's exactly what we need. It's a grassroots, up from the ground, up from the roots, fight for an increase in the minimum wage here and across the world. And of course, you know, we have this awful inequality all over the world. And the only way we can deal with it is if, you know, workers get a real wage. And that's what this is. And it's so exciting. And it's not just a policy initiative. It's a real workers' fight. It's a real grassroots fight. And that's one of the things I like about it most.
Stuart, let me ask you a question. You know, we heard from fast food workers all over the world. And, you know, one of them was saying, you know, I make $21 an hour and I've got benefits. Yeah. And now, yeah. What is it? American managers just aren't that bright? Or is it, you know, that managers overseas in other countries are just that much smarter? Or what's the deal on this? Why can it happen?
It can happen here. The difference is that in some places in the world, in many places in the world, in most places in the Western democracies, unionization is assumed. You go into an enterprise and you sign up for the union, and the union negotiates your wages and benefits and hours and conditions of employment. This is the only, you know, America is the only Western democracy, only first world country where unionization is so difficult to achieve. And in the Netherlands, which is where that, I think that person came from, Unionization is just assumed, and that's the case in all of Western Europe, which, by the way, you know, has mandatory 4-week vacations every year, has in most countries 35-hour weeks instead of 40-hour weeks, and in most countries has, you know, paid paternity or maternity leave, and in most countries has a much higher standard of living for workers than we do, and much less poverty.
You know, it seems to me like there's some good answers there.
And there absolutely are some good answers there. I mean, it has to do with who you run the economy for. Do you run the economy only for the wealthiest in your country and treat everybody else like a serf? Or do you run the economy for everybody in the country? And that's what we're dealing with in America. We have gotten to the point where we run the economy only for the wealthiest in the country and treat everybody else like a serf. And, you know, it has to do with who is your priority. And in most Western democracies, with much more manufacturing than we have, much less unemployment than we have, much higher standard of living than we have, the economy is run for the entire population, not just for those at the, you know, 1% or the, you know, now it comes out that it's not just the 1%, it's the half of the 1% at the very top.
Stuart, what do we have to do in this country to get the playing field back to level?
Well, you know, thank you for that question, because I'm beginning to write about that a lot. We have to focus on two things. We have two crises that affect this country and the whole world. One is inequality, and the other is global climate change. And we have to make sure that everybody we support, every politician we support, is on board with doing something about inequality, lessening inequality, raising the minimum wage, allowing workers to organize freely and bargain collectively, and doing something about global climate change. It is within our power to fix both of these problems. These are not an act of God. It is within our power to fix both of these problems, and we've got to do it not only for us, but for future generations.
I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly on this, Stuart. I think, you know, my question to you is, and when we come back, we'll answer this, but my question to you is, are we seeing those first sparks? Are we seeing those first steps in doing that? Or if not, what do we got to do to get there? Okay?
Good.
I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. Also, don't forget, join our e-activist newsletter. It's there on the center of our main page, theunionedge.com. You can't miss it. Big red bar. If your organization, your local needs some help, let us know. We'll get the word out. If you're willing to help, let us know. We'll get the word to you. It's called solidarity. That's why we do this. Joining us right now by phone, Stuart Acuff, organizer extraordinaire. Stuart, welcome back.
and president of the Charles Showalter fan club.
There you go, man. There you go. Hey, listen, Stuart, is this time, you know, are we seeing the sparks of a resurgence in organizing in this country?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
You know, we are seeing the sparks of resurgence in organizing in this country. And we are seeing the the beginning. Maybe we're halfway through of the skepticism and the realization that the whole Ronald Reagan top-down theory of economics was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Trickle-down economics doesn't work. It's not trickle-down, it's tinkle-down.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great mentor. You're going to get mad at me for saying this, but there's no cuss words, so you can't cut me off. That trickle-down economics was like feeding the horse so the birds could eat. Of course, because for those of your listeners who are city folks, the corn passes through a horse or a donkey or a cow intact. Without being digested.
Right.
So, and that's probably a little too much visualization. But we are seeing people waking up to the fact that unregulated, unfettered financialization, capitalism does not work. You have to harness market forces for the people, for the society, for the country. And if you don't, if you let it just run wild, it's ultimately very destructive.
What do you think the next steps are we're going to see as we're continuing to build momentum with the labor movement in this country?
Well, we have to focus on two things, I think. And I'm writing about this a lot now, and other people are writing about this a lot now. We have to see a decrease in the inequality in wealth and income in America. It makes no sense that almost all of the increase in wealth in America for years now has gone to the top one half of 1% in this country. Now, let me tell you why that's really bad. Okay, you can say, oh, that's class warfare. Oh, we've heard that so many. You can say all that crap. But here's the real problem with it. How many jobs does that wealth create when it's relegated to the top half of 1%. Okay, so they buy another 94-foot-long yacht. But if it's spread through the economy, it goes into groceries, it goes into housing, it goes into school taxes, it goes into the local grocery store and the 7-Eleven. You know, it goes much further when it's spread through the economy. So we have to do something about the inequality of wealth and income. And there's two simple things we can do about that. Very, very simple. We've had this debate in America for 80 years. And one is raise the minimum wage.
Right.
And the second is, very simply, give everybody the absolute, unmitigated, unfettered right to form a union and bargain collectively. Neither one of those
cost the federal government any money.
Right. Neither one of them is a radical concept by any stretch of the imagination.
Neither one's a radical concept.
Absolutely. Stuart, we have got to get going, brother. I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you. Stuart Acuff, organizer extraordinaire. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
It takes a certain strength of character to be able to stand up and say, I don't believe in the norm. This is actually what I believe. I know it's completely different and out of whack with what most people are doing. There's so many more undiscovered stories of what KBOO has done in people's lives, what it has meant to Portland. This radio station has had a ripple effect that we don't even know.
Start writing your KBOO story and see what ripples out. Come to our next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, May 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue here at your community radio station, KBOO.
National Tap Dance Day is May 24th, and KBOO is proud to co-sponsor a celebration of tap dance. Tap workshops will be held from 12:15 to 5:15 at the Grand Finale Dance Studio at 875 Portland Avenue in Gladstone, Oregon. And at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, there will be performances including Yearly Sunset, Shoehorn, Aaron Wheeler K, and Skylark Tappers. Again, that's May 24th at the Grand Finale Dance Studio and the Clinton Street Theater. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit PD.